We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Hello, this is David Teal, your guest host for the next hour of Focus. Many children, especially boys, have a fascination with dinosaurs. But for some, the allure of these prehistoric giants never wears off. Some become paleontologists, curating bones for a museum. Others become commercial fossil hunters, scouring the ranches of the American West for the next big score. Today's guest is Richard Polsky, who came at the dinosaur hunt from an entirely different angle. At the age of 50, he put his career as a private dealer in contemporary art on hold while he took up his childhood dream to find his very own Tyrannosaurus rex. Along the way, he met a colorful cast of characters, including the self-styled Fossil King. He wrote about his quest in the book Bonehead's My Search for T-Rex. You're welcome to call in with your questions and comments. The number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the area, anywhere in the U.S., you can use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. And you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Good morning, Mr. Polsky. Welcome to Focus.
Yes, good morning.
Oh, it's great to have you. I know it's very early where you are this morning.
Not so bad. 8 o'clock. I've had my coffee. Ready to go.
Very good. So, well, let's get a little bit into your background before you, kind of dabbled in paleontology here. You're an art dealer. I guess you wrote a couple of books on Andy Warhol.
Correct.
And how does one go from art dealing to fossil hunting?
Well, it's a funny path because I was a geology major in college. I went to Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, not that far from you, and started out in geology. And after 2 weeks, I was flunking out of school because I didn't realize geology was an earth science, obviously. Funny how that was the truth. And a lot of physics, a lot of calculus, a lot of math, and I couldn't handle it. And after 2 weeks, I realized I better do something, and I switched over to art, which is another love of mine. A lot easier, much easier major. Nude models,
Right.
You know, you're not that stressed out exactly. But anyway, the long and short of it was I realized, I had an epiphany, and what I really liked about fossils and minerals were the aesthetics. I loved the way a fossil trilobite looked, a black trilobite, in the surrounding gray matrix in the rock it was found in. I wasn't that interested in the science. And I realized, you know, my love of fossils was really a visual experience. Anyway, though, I did become an art dealer and did okay at it and made a little money. And I did, as you pointed out, I turned 50. And I realized, you know, it's one of those moments in life where you look back and say, geez, what if I had gutted it out as a geology major, you know, got some tutoring, found a way to get through it, and became a paleontologist? What would my life look like? And I started having regrets. You know, it was like a lot of remorse. And through a connection in New York, there's a paleontologist. His name is Henry Galliano. He owns a shop on Columbus Avenue called Maxilla and Mandible. They were the first to treat fossils and minerals as aesthetic objects, as works of art. And he had become a good friend. And I called him up one day and I said, hey, Henry, I know this sounds crazy, but I want to go out. I want to get out into the field and, you know, get a T-Rex. And he thought, I guess he misunderstood me. He says, well, look, Richard, you know, we have a tooth available by a Rex. It's only a few $1,000s, you know. I go, no, I want to go out and find my own. And there was silence. And he says, well, I guess I could, you know, get behind that, if we could figure something out. And that's what led to this whole thing.
And, you know, let's, you know, put this in perspective. I mean, there aren't very many T-Rex skeletons in the world, that at least that have been found.
Well, you make a good point. When I undertook this, there were approximately 40 or so T-Rexes that had been found in the history of paleontology, which is nothing. It's not a common dinosaur. It's a famous dinosaur. It's probably the most famous, but it's one of the rarest. And the analogy I give people is, if you go to, let's say, the Serengeti Plains in Africa and you examine the wildlife structure there, there are, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of wildebeest and zebras, but there are relatively few predators like the large predators like lions. And it was probably the same thing in prehistoric times with T-Rexes versus, let's say, Triceratopses. They're called iguanodons. You know, these were common animals, plant eaters.
Right, you know, you need a bunch of plant eaters to support one big, you know, mega predator like that.
Yeah. So there weren't a lot of rexes to begin with. So I was pursuing something that was, I was coming at it from more of a layman's, everyman's viewpoint. It was just one of those fantasies where it's like, what do I have to lose?
Right.
So I figured, okay, let's see what we could do here.
And what do you think is the fascination with T-Rex specifically?
Everyone asks that, and it's one of those things that's hard to articulate. I think it's just something that fires the imagination. You know, the scale of it, the size of its teeth, what we've seen in movies like Jurassic Park, it's just impregnated in our psyche that, whoa, a T-Rex, you know. And it starts as a child. You probably realize, do you have children yourself?
I don't have children, okay. But I am a child myself.
You're
so.
Okay. Well, if you think back, kids knew the names of every dinosaur more than the adults knew. They all knew a T-Rex, or it was called a Brontosaurus at the time, and a Stegosaurus. You know, there's just something about these large creatures that just gets people going, and you can't always put it into words as to why.
One thing, well, and I was one of those children, and did know all those names. I've kind of lost touch with it after a while. And I think one of the things that really struck me about the book is, I mean, I almost got the impression that, you know, there's T-Rex and then there's everything else. And you know, seemed like everybody was just obsessed with finding another Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton.
Okay. Now, the point you're raising, now we're getting into something that's monetary.
Seems to be a big thing. I mean, very important.
Well, they're valuable. I know your listeners are primarily in Illinois, and a lot of you folks out there probably know that the ultimate T-Rex, a dinosaur called Sue, is at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. And as most of you probably know, it sold for $8.3 million at Sotheby's not that long ago. So now you have, you know, this lottery mentality out there when people are searching for dinosaurs. If you find a Rex and you find the skull with the teeth, you're a millionaire, basically. They're that valuable. And that gets a lot of people worked up, I'll tell you.
Now, I mean, say you get, you know, like a big plant eater, a Triceratops,
right,
or a Stegosaurus or something. I mean, what's the difference, in pricing there?
Well, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars versus millions of dollars.
Wow.
And again, I need to point out that people don't realize this, but when you find a dinosaur out in the field, it's not what you think. In other words, it's not this perfect articulated skeleton where all the bones are there, none of them are cracked, everything lines up, and it's very easy to remove from the earth. For those who saw Jurassic Park, I'm assuming you saw it.
Yes.
There's a scene early in the movie where I think it was Laura Dern playing paleontologist's girlfriend, I forgot his name, and they're out in the field and they're in these carefully pressed khaki shorts and jackets. And they have a late model SUV, and they find a dinosaur, and they take a brush, and they brush away sand, and you see this perfect dinosaur still in the ground. And most people think, oh, yeah, that's how it's done. It's nothing like that. It's, you know, when you find a Rex, up until Sue, the most complete specimen that had ever been found was only 50% complete. They only had half the bones.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason is when a dinosaur died, often scavengers, you know, the hyenas of the day, would come and, you know, pick it apart, and bones would be carried off. Or let's say it was overcome in a flood, in a flash-moving flash flood. Bones are, again, scattered. So it's very hard to find the whole thing intact. And by the way, when Sue was found, it was 90% complete. And the state of preservation was excellent. And it was a big example. You know, it was one of those amazing things. So finding dinosaurs actually is real messy work, and it's often thankless. It's, you know, I've been out in the field with some of these people in the book, some of the crazies, who we can talk about later if you'd like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard, dirty work. You're out there digging, and you find a lot of dinosaur bones. They're not rare, but most of them have minimal value, both to science and to collectors. You know, there's an expression in the dinosaur business. It has to have horns, claws, or teeth, or you're not going to make any money. It has to be a sexy dinosaur.
And that did really strike me. I said, you know, you grow up to think that, you know, fossils are relatively rare, and it really sounds like, you know, in some of these places you're almost tripping over bones, yet a lot of the bones are not worth the trouble it takes to get them out of the ground.
That's correct. It's a lot of work to remove a bone from the ground, and then you got to cover it in a plaster of Paris field jacket to protect it till you get it back home to clean it up and work on it and so on. And it's just, if you don't think you've got something that's either new to science or there's a market for it, you just leave it. And the sad thing is, as we speak right now, there are thousands of bones weathering out of the ground that within two or three years are going to be destroyed because, you know, the effects of sand and wind and snow and rain, erosion, it destroys all this stuff. And there's plenty of it. It is not rare. Great examples are rare. But there's, let's say, a ton of petrified wood out there. For those who have been to Petrified Forest National Park, once you leave the park, there's still plenty of petrified wood out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge geologic formation where the stuff was formed. It's crazy. Fossils and dinosaur bones are not rare. If you've ever been to Florida, there's a beach on the west coast called in the town of Venice where you can go out and find shark teeth, fossil shark teeth, all day long. I mean, most of them are only the size of a dime or a quarter. They're not that great. But they're there. There are lots of them. I mean, there's literally, people don't realize there are fossils in all 48 states. In terms of, you know, the general United States. I'm pretty sure Alaska, not sure about Hawaii, but there are fossils everywhere.
Well, I know when I was a kid out in the playground, you know, you would go through, you had all that limestone rock sitting around, and I was always looking for crinoid stems and things
right,
like that.
Right, right. Illinois has a lot of that.
Yeah.
Illinois is a very good state for finding fossil fern leaves. There's a place called, it's called Mazon Creek, M-A-Z-O-N. I forgot what part of Illinois it's in. And they're nodules. They're little round nodules, maybe 3-4 inches long. And if you split them in half, and you're lucky, you'll find a perfectly preserved fern leaf. Yeah, Illinois is a great state for fossil hunting.
Take a moment here just to remind our listeners, our guest in this hour of focus is Richard Polsky. He's author of the book Boneheads, My Search for T-Rex. You can call in with your comments and questions at 217-333-9455 or toll free at 800-222-9455. And you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's talk about Sue for a bit here, because, I mean, I think this is a subject that, as you say, I mean, people in Illinois are familiar with Sue, but she was apparently there was a great deal of controversy surrounding her.
Yeah, I know a lot about that. See, this ties into the book, Boneheads, very nicely. What had happened was my friend Henry Galliano in New York, who set up my T-Rex expedition, was friends with a Native American named Maurice Williams. Maurice Williams was the South Dakota rancher on whose land Sue was found. Okay, and there have been several books written on this, so I'll keep it brief. But basically, a well-known dinosaur hunter from South Dakota named Peter Larson was involved in the excavation of Sue. And when it was found, he cut a deal with Maurice Williams. He gave him a check for $5,000 for the dinosaur. And nobody knew at the time how big it was and how great it was. They just knew it was a dinosaur, and they knew it was a Rex from what they found on the surface. So Maurice Williams is like, oh, my God. You know, he shows his wife the check, and she's like, quick, let's spend it before he changes his mind. But Maurice's son was a little more savvy, and he said, Dad, $5,000 for a T-Rex? You got to be kidding me. This is nothing. You're getting ripped off. And Maurice is a very proud man, and apparently one thing led to another. Attorneys got involved, and it took him about 2 weeks, to get Sue out of the ground, And once that had happened, the FBI came in, and it was confiscated. And they found, you know, the lawyers uncovered all these laws because Maurice, being a Native American, had put his land into government trust. So he needed government permission, actually, to sell the wrecks to Peter Larson. And they, you know, we'll flash forward. It went to court. Larson lost. Maurice got the dinosaur. And Larson was sentenced to 2.5 months in prison. It wasn't oversued. They had uncovered other irregularities in his collecting. Fossils taken from Bureau of Land Management land, taking more than $10,000 in cash out of the country to buy dinosaurs. You know, it was all this crazy stuff. And, you know, Peter wrote a wonderful book called Rex Appeal that your readers might enjoy, and it'll explain his side of it, which is compelling. Anyway, long story short, I was able to go up to Maurice Williams' land where Sue was found. And I was only like the third person he ever allowed out there. He had a serious mistrust of the white man. There's no other way to put it. And I had one of the great days of my life going out to the Sioux site to look for another Rex. He gave me 2 hours to go out and look for something. And his parting words to me were, remember, if you find something, it's mine. So, you know, I was like, oh, okay, Maurice, it's all yours, don't worry. So basically I had 2 months to search for a T-Rex on his property. And I found a few bones out there. I knew they were dinosaur bones, but I didn't know what type of dinosaur. And I also found, I think it was a crocodile tooth, an ancient tooth. So anyway, the next day I FedExed the bones to New York to my friend Henry at Maxilla and Mandible. And I get a call on my cell phone. He goes, sorry, cell phone. He says, sorry, Richard, no T-Rex. And I'm like, wait a minute, are you sure it really could be, don't you think? Because it has a certain structure to the bone. He's like, look, I'm telling you, you know, I'm really sorry. And, God, I was crushed. I really thought I had found something. Anyway, so it didn't happen, and at least initially.
Mm-hmm. And that was something you mentioned, just the structure of it. And I hadn't realized that the T-Rex skeleton had a particular structure to it that differentiated it from the other big meat-eating dinosaurs.
Well, you know, I guess meat-eating dinosaurs are called theropods.
Mm-hmm.
And the center of their bone is, you know, bone is bone. It all has these little fissures and holes where, you know, the blood was pumped through,
mm-hmm.
the blood ran through. And the structure in a meat-eating dinosaur's bone, I guess, is different than a plant eater's. So it's called camelid structure. I forgot how to spell it. And you can tell out in the field when you hold up a piece of bone whether it's from a meat eater or not. Now, whether it's a Rex or an Allosaurus or something else, we don't know. The only way you often know for certain is by finding the teeth or the jaw or the skull. That's always the key to all this.
So, you know, you touched a little bit here on, you know, kind of the complicated web of, seems like a complicated web of interconnections here between the ranchers and the fossil hunters and the government. And maybe can you elaborate a little bit on
well,
that?
It's a funny dance. You know, I mean, a lot of it just comes down to money. I hate to put it that way. I mean, you find a Rex tooth, they sell for $1,000 an inch. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And a Rex tooth with the root intact, which is rare, you usually only find that when it's in the jaw, can run, you know, 10, 11, 12 inches. So each tooth's worth a lot of money. When you find one out in the field, you usually find the tip of it 2-3 inches, serrated edge, shaped almost like a banana. They're kind of robust. You know, so you find something that's 3 inches long, you found a $3,000 tooth. And, you talk about the government and the ranchers and the dinosaur hunters. And it's a funny, funny situation where on the one hand, you have the PhDs at universities who insist, hey, none of these amateur paleontologists like myself, none of these commercial dealers like Peter Larson or Henry Galliano, dinosaurs are only for us. We know what to do when we find one. We're going to study it. We're going to write papers on it. We're going to preserve the knowledge. And there's more to it than that. The great commercial dinosaur hunters are very concerned with doing the right thing. When they're out in the field, they're making extensive notes when they find a dinosaur as to where it was found. They're mapping out where the bones were, what's the geologic layer it was found in, what's the formation, partly because it's the right thing to do, and partly you get a lot more money for a dinosaur when you preserve the scientific information, just the way it is, okay? So You know, my point is there are enough fossils and dinosaurs out there for everyone, the amateurs, the PhDs, the ranchers. There's plenty out there. And you have the more people you have out looking for dinosaurs, the better. You're going to find more. Or the rest just, like I said, weathers away.
And again, for our listeners, we're talking to Richard Polsky. He's author of the book Boneheads, My Search for T-Rex. We're taking questions at 217-333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, or will-talk at illinois.edu if you prefer to contact us via email. As far as you know, the government part of this, of course, too, is, I mean, you've got, you're describing at one point, you know, people using, GPS devices just to make sure that they didn't happen to wander off into government land.
Correct.
Because that opens up a whole new kettle of shark teeth?
Most dinosaurs were found, you know, in the areas of Wyoming, South Dakota, Colorado, Utah, and so on. And they're generally found in badlands. Badlands meaning there's no vegetation on the surface. You know, it's just clean rock, clean mudstone, where you can see things that have weathered out. There's a lot of land in that area that's Bureau of Land Management that belongs to the government. And obviously there are fossils there. There are a lot of fossils on Indian reservations. There are a lot of fossils on ranches. And to get on government land and collect, you need a permit. And generally, again, you got to be a PhD at a university or a museum to get one of these permits. So commercial dinosaur hunters turn to ranchers. You know, private land, you can do what you want. So the latest paradigm for doing this is you cut a deal with the rancher. You basically say, look, I think there are dinosaurs on your land. I would like permission to look. If I find anything, you and I are partners, and I will give you 10%. Of anything I find in terms of money that when things are sold, and you sign a contract and so on. And that's what's done now. And then you have, academics are furious with this because they have very little money. I mean, the academics are rarely out in the field. There are no grants to finance all this, very little. But the commercial dinosaur hunters are out every day that it's not snowing, let's say, or raining. They're out there. And, they have money. They can afford to make deals, a lot of these guys. And the ranchers are like, hey, you know, it's like timber rights or mineral rights on their property, another source of income. Why not?
Yeah, and that had surprised me as well because, I mean, I came, you know, came at it with a traditional view of the paleontologist. And, I mean, you do think it's going to be, you know, people coming from a scientific institute or a museum or something going out into the field. And it sounds like, you know, that really doesn't happen all that much anymore.
No, that's true. I mean, you know, the world's changed. It's, everything comes down to money right now. Sad, but true.
Yeah. And so, I mean, most of the big dinosaurs that we're seeing at, you know, like say, the Field Museum or, for us, the Children's Museum of Indianapolis isn't
that
far away.
Yeah, that's a terrific museum. In fact, I mentioned there's a story in my book, Boneheads, about a fossil hunter named Bucky Derflinger. How's that for a name?
That is a great name.
It's a great name, right? And he's a cool guy. He looks a little like Robert Redford, and he's very athletic, very hip guy. He's still under 40, I believe. And he found a great T-Rex on his father's ranch, and they sold it for about $1 million to the Indianapolis Children's Museum. So there's some great stuff there.
Yeah. So So it's just I guess a real surprise that, you know, these things really aren't, you know, the Children's Museum doesn't go and send, you know, somebody out to find
whatever. No, it's much easier to have someone else do it and then go to your trustees and backers and say, look, we have an opportunity to buy a great specimen. And museums, again, I hate to keep talking about money, but it's reality. They need star dinosaurs to draw crowds who will buy tickets, spend money at their gift shops, eat at their cafes. You have one great T-Rex, you're going to get people in there. That's what people want to see, and that's why they're so valuable. It's, again, the usual supply and demand thing. And the Field Museum spent an awful lot of money to get Sue, and I know a lot of it was financed by McDonald's Corporation, and it's embarrassing. I forgot the other people who put up the money. But it didn't matter what they paid, because now they have a star. It's kind of like having LeBron James play for the Miami Heat. It's the same thing. People want to see the stars. When I live in San Francisco, and Barry Bonds was playing for the Giants, and man, attendance soared. Everybody wants to see Barry Bonds. And it's like that with a great T-Rex like Sue. People just want to see it.
Well, and the merchandising rights, too.
Oh, my God.
I have a Sue magnet on my fridge. So
there you go. It just goes on and on and on. You can't pay enough for something that's really great. And that's true of a great Andy Warhol painting. It's true of a great dinosaur. One thing I wanted to point out in the book, which I thought was kind of humorous, because the book, it's not a serious book. It's more of a fun book. It's more written with, you know, laughter in mind and the absurdity of what goes on in that business. It's not about science. And one of the things that I talk about are these wacky dinosaur hunters that I met. There's a guy named Bob Dietrich who calls himself the Fossil King.
Yeah, he was my favorite.
Well, everybody likes Bob Dietrich. You can't believe, after the book, how many calls we got from TV producers who wanted to do reality shows on wacky dinosaur hunters. But so far, nothing's come of it. It's all talk, you know. I get probably one letter a month from someone saying, hey, I've got this great idea. Can I interview you? I want to pitch this book as a show. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's all talk. But anyway, so you have Bob Dietrich out there, and everything he finds in his mind is a T-Rex, and it's up to you to prove otherwise. Like, he'll hand you a bone, and he'll say, I got a Rex, and you'll look at him and say, what? He goes, well, prove to me it isn't. And you're like, well, wait a minute, you know, it's insanity. I mean, the guy's really crazy, but he's a great guy. You know, he claimed he has trouble with identification. I think that's the big issue there, little trouble. And you got two guys in the book called the Bonehead Brothers, Stan and Steve Sackerson. They're fossil hunting twins, and they're whack jobs. One lives in his car. The other one is a grave digger by day. That's his profession. You know, it attracts a lot of really crazy people, this business.
And, yeah, the fossil king, you know, Bob Dietrich, the thing that I initially came away with reading the book was that, you know, it seemed like the other people around him were the ones really making the big discoveries, and yet he just kept saying he was the fossil king.
Well, you know, you repeat something often enough, you know, you start believing your own stuff, you know, your own BS, your own nonsense. And he really believed he was like the Messiah when it came to finding fossils. You know, the big trend in the dinosaur business now, for instance, is not the selling the original skeletons, because it's become so difficult and so expensive to dig them up and get permission and, you know, mount the bones and preserve them. It's just so much work and money. That the big industry now is casts of these dinosaurs, and that's where this is all going. And in a recent interview, the Fossil King said, look, some are good at, you know, making them. I'm good at finding them. And people love, he's very quotable. He says funny things like that. You know, he's referred to himself as a fossil terrorist, whatever that means. In these times, maybe not the best choice of words. But he says things like this, and the press loves it. They love quoting him. And suddenly, he's a bit of a star, even though he's never found a T-Rex.
Right, right.
But he believes he has. He believes he was part of all these.
And he finds them pretty much every day, too.
Pretty much. Yeah, you know, when I got involved with them, you know, the first part of the book ends with failure, where I'm at Maurice Williams Ranch where Sue is found, and I didn't get a Rex. And I had pretty much given up. And then I get a call from the Fossil King, and he's like, look, Richard, you want to find a Rex, you talk to me. He says, I've already got two of them in the ground that I've located. You need to get up here right away, and you can be part of this. And it's like, what do I have to lose at this point? So I went up there, and it was insane. I think one of the things he found was a fossil turtle. It was a turtle. Even I could see that. He goes, no, you're not looking. You know, it's like, it's crazy. It's like an alternate universe with some of these guys.
Well, we're going to take just a very quick break here, but we'll be right back with Richard Polsky.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store. Strawberry Fields offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Richard Polsky. He's author of the book Boneheads, My Search for T-Rex. You're welcome to call in with your comments and questions at 217-333-9455 or toll free 800-222-9455. And of course, you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. So back to the fossil king and his friends, it was just an intriguing bunch of characters, and I guess what got me was just the kind of the, almost the flea market aspect of selling fossils. And so you talk a bit about there's a gem, mineral, and fossil showcase in Tucson every year.
Yes. I would encourage all of your listeners to attend this. This is the most fun I've ever had in my entire life, which is saying something. I've had a lot of good times. Every late January, early February, usually runs 2 weeks in the city of Tucson, Arizona. Not Phoenix, Tucson, near Mexico. Very different mentality down there. Anyway, it's the world's largest fossil gem and mineral show. And people come from all over the world, and you can't believe how big this is. Basically, what people do is they rent a motel room, the exhibitors. You rent a room, and during the day, you spread your fossils and minerals out on the desk, on your bedspread, in your bathroom, and at night, you pack it all up and sleep in the bed, and then you do it all over again the next day. So visitors go from motel room to motel room, and there might be 8 of these motels scattered throughout the city. Then the convention center has a high-end show, and it's a lot of fun. And you can ask questions and touch things, and you can find anything. They had a whole woolly mammoth there. Can you imagine that? A whole woolly mammoth. Some Russian dealer had it, and I think it was $250,000. And I don't know where you put it. I mean, it's 14 feet tall, but you could buy anything there. I mean, you could buy a little strand of woolly mammoth hair for $20.
And you go out and clone your own, right?
You could do that, yeah. I mean, but, there are things there for $1 and there are things there for $1 million. And it's hysterical. The biggest trend down there are Moroccan fossil dealers. And these guys are the most dishonest thing I've ever seen. They have all these fake trilobites. We call them, do most people know what a trilobite is? I'm wondering.
Possibly not. Go ahead.
Well, a trilobite, it's a little marine creature. Most of them are a couple inches long. They look like pill bugs. They're like little crabs, and they have antenna and appendages. They're generally black. Unique marine life, very common, so many varieties. So what these Russian dealers would do is they'd glue antenna from different species on one another, and they'd say, oh, this is a whole new species. We've never seen this before. And then they'd have these cave bears, which are more recent Ice Age creatures, not true fossils. And they take bones from different bears they'd find in caves and whatnot, and they'd mount them, and they'd claim, oh, it's all from, the bones are all from one creature. But they're not. It's like a Frankenstein. They're from different creatures that they assemble. And if they're all from the same one, you can get more money for it. And there's a lot of chicanery and a lot of nonsense that goes on at the show, but there's a lot of great stuff, too. And you see curators from the Smithsonian walking around in the Field Museum. You see professors. You name it, you see it down there. And if you can imagine, you're at a motel with, let's say, 100 rooms, and you're just going from room to room. It's like speed reading. You poke your head in the door. You see if there's anything that interests you, and you go, oh, they have quartz crystals. Not for me. And you go to the next room, and you go, oh, they have geodes. Yeah, I want that. So you go in there. And it's a cash business, very little credit card action. It's almost all cash. A lot of negotiating, a lot of bargaining. It's great. Oh.
We have a caller on line 4 from
sure.
Bloomington, Illinois. Line 4?
Yeah, this is very interesting. Thank you. I had two questions. I was just wondering about the details and the legality of removing these fossils from Indian property, how that works. And then the other question is these crazies that collectors or hunters, I guess, do they make any money, or are they just out there to be goofy?
Okay, I'll try to answer that. Well, the first question about collecting on reservations on Indian land, you need permission. You just can't walk out there and take something that doesn't belong to you. So you have to go to the tribal council or whoever's ranch it is and secure oral or written permission from that person, preferably written. And, you know, it's as simple as that. It's like even if you live in suburbia and someone, let's say you have a tree with, pecans on it, you can't just walk into someone's yard and start taking their pecans or their apples. You knock on their door and say, hey, you know, I love pecans. Would you mind if I, picked up a few? And that it's the same with fossils, really. As far as goofy people out in the field, do they make any money? Once in a while, not very often. Once in a while, you score something big. This guy I talk about, the Fossil King, his biggest score was $400,000. He found a Triceratops skull, with the three horns coming out of it, and it was in remarkably good condition. But he only saw about $100,000 of it because he had to pay the rancher off. He had to pay preparators, people to clean it up, which takes hours and hours of, fine work with dental tools to clean these things. Then he had to have someone mount it. Then he had to ship it somewhere. So there's not a lot of money in this. And that was his biggest score. That carried him for a while. People do it for the love of it, for the adventure. It's the Indiana Jones effect.
Is the government involved in the Indian reservation?
I don't know. I don't know the specifics of that. I'm sorry.
You said the FBI came out there.
Well, that's a different story. The FBI... it's too long a story to go into, but if you read Peter Larson's book, Rex Appeal, the whole thing is in there, how it went down. You might enjoy it.
Okay. Well, thank you for a very interesting.
You're welcome.
And once again, our guest is Richard Polsky. He's author of the book Boneheads, My Search for T-Rex. We're taking questions and comments at 217-333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email at will-talk@illinois.edu. We have just a little under 15 minutes left. We're just talking there again about, the case of Sue, and it just seemed like, you get... Well, I guess I was curious, and maybe you don't want to respond to this. I don't know. But, do you feel like, did you take a side ultimately in the Maurice Williams, Peter Larson thing, or do you want to say?
Well, it's a hard thing because, I know both of these people, and I like them both. They're both good guys. This is funny in the book. There's a chapter where I go out to Maurice's house. We didn't know each other. And he's a big, intimidating guy, even though he's about 70 at the time when I met him. He's probably about 6'2", 220. He's a big guy, and he means business. And, ranchers have tough lives. They don't have easy lives. These are guys who are dependent on the weather and the luck of the draw with their cattle. By that I mean, if there are no diseases going around, a lot can go wrong until the beef comes to market and they make their money. And, they don't suffer any fools, these guys. These are serious men. So when I met Maurice for the first time, his first question was, whose side are you on? Are you on Peter Larson's side or are you on my side? I want to know right now. And I realized if I didn't give the right answer, I was out of there. My expedition was over before it started. And I didn't know what to do because I really saw both sides of the argument. On the one hand, if you're an art dealer, let's say in my business, and I give you $5,000, let's say, for an Andy Warhol painting, and you cash the check, that's my painting. You know what I'm saying? We made a deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's like as a kid trading baseball cards or marbles. A deal's a deal. It's no different. But in this case, there was a cash check. On the other hand, Maurice had a point where he claimed that, he was hoodwinked. He wasn't offered a fair price, and he was taken advantage of. And it's a funny dance because both of them have a point. So I thought fast, and I said, look, if I were Peter and I found that Rex, I would have immediately said, hey, this is a great thing I think we got here. Let's be partners on it. We'll go 50-50. And Maurice looked at me after I said that, and he nodded. He goes, well, that would have been the right thing to do. And I was, it's the proverbial sigh of relief. Great, I passed the test. I was allowed out. And then all was well. We had a great time. Though I almost screwed up once where he's taking me around. We're in this giant Ford pickup truck, and we're bouncing around his property and looking around. And I said to him, God, this is a wonderful, beautiful place you have here. What a spread. How many acres do you own? And all of a sudden, he gave me a dirty look. And he said, hey, that's like asking a man, how much money does he have? And I didn't realize that rancher etiquette is you never ask that question. That's a bad question. Someone wants to volunteer, yeah, I have 20,000 acres, fine, let them. But you don't ask that. It's considered a highly personal thing. And I didn't know. I felt terrible. So there was all this awkward silence for a while, you know, and I apologized profusely. And, you know, it's a funny thing, all this stuff. Anyway.
How many people has he allowed out there? I mean, this
was
super
rare. Well, I was only the
rare.
Third person he let out. He had, a profound distrust of people. You know, there were a lot of, after Sue was found, a lot of universities and their paleontology departments got in touch with him. And they said, you know, I don't know which schools, but, you know, we're so-and-so from the school. And, look, you know, we'd like to mount an expedition or secure permission to come out and just meet you and see what else might be out there. We have a feeling where there's one, there are more, which wasn't a bad theory. That could be the case. And he said no to everybody. He goes, no, thanks. I don't need that. And so Henry was the only one he trusted because Henry was hired by Sotheby's as a go-between to meet with Maurice and talk him through the process of selling the dinosaur at auction, and they became friends. And the fact that Henry is of mixed ethnicity made Maurice comfortable. Henry was, he was part Chinese and part Cuban. You know, very unusual combination. So Maurice trusted him because he was, he felt like, well, we're both kind of outsiders in society. You know, I could trust you. And by Henry vouching for me, that's the only reason I was allowed out there. I mean, I was very lucky, I felt.
We have about 10 minutes left in the program, and we're welcoming your questions at 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. What's the market like for dinosaur fossils these days?
It's a little weak right now. See, the thing with a dinosaur is most museums around the world, you know, be it in Japan or here in America, they have a dinosaur or two, and they go a long way. You know what I mean? There's just, you know, there's no room to put these places. So there's not, you know, the market right now, I think, is heading in the direction of more for decoration, for people thinking, God, this will look good in my home if it's on a pedestal to have, you know, a jaw from, you know, a Diplodocus or something. You know, it's like that. It's kind of going more in the decorative thing than the scientific thing. So I'm not sure what the future of all this really is.
You talked about the effect, the effect of Jurassic Park on the dinosaur market.
Well, that's the thing. You know, you need to tie it to an event in popular culture. If there's another Jurassic Park that's made or something similar, or let's say scientists uncover a nest of T-Rex eggs, which has never happened. They have never found a T-Rex egg. They found other dinosaur eggs, even predators, never a Rex. Something like that would spark a new wave of collecting. It has to be tied into a big-time event.
And you said that eBay also had an effect on the market.
Well, yeah, eBay, you know, it's amazing what you can buy on eBay. It's shocking. And if you go on eBay, yeah, there are all sorts of fossils and minerals and dinosaur bones for sale. But that's tricky. I mean, you need to see the stuff in person. You need to handle it. There's an aesthetic to all this.
We have another caller on line one from Champaign. Good morning, Champaign.
Yeah, just a short question. Did the author have any finds or any experiences there? I'll just go off here.
Did you find anything during your experiences out there?
Yeah, I mean, I found a lot of things, but nothing of any great value. One of the funniest things that happened is we were out in the field. I was with the Fossil King and the Bonehead Brothers. And, you know, we're walking in a single file and we're looking, you know, scanning the ground with our eyes and all that. And I apparently stepped over a small T-Rex tooth. I didn't even see it. The tip of a tooth, and Stan, one of the Bonehead brothers, one of the twins, saw it, and he says, Richard, look what you missed, and I felt terrible. And he goes, here it is. And sure enough, it was only about an inch long. It was the tip of one. It was pretty badly weathered, but it was a Rex tooth. So he carefully, you know, dug it up, and, you know, I was humiliated. I go, how did I not see it? And we determined, since it was in such poor condition, it was only worth $250. So we gave the rancher, he got 20%. Bob Dietrich gives double. Most people give 10%. He gives 20%. So he hands the rancher $50, and he goes, great, I think I'll take the wife to dinner. So I bought it for the $250. I said, look, I want it as a souvenir of my trip. So I gave him $250. So Bob Dietrich keeps $100, and Stan keeps $100. They split 50-50. So that was the big find, and I didn't even find it. But I have it. It's in my drawer right now. It was funny.
Well, you know, and yeah, it just sounded like it was just a great little adventure. Do you plan to follow up on that at all?
You know, I'd love to, but, you know, the reality was it was a moment in time, so to speak, where, you know, all the stars lined up, where I was able to get out to Maurice Williams Ranch and had someone help me do it. You know, and times are always changing, and there's always something else going on. You know, right now I'm back at work working on some new books. I actually have a book coming out in 3 weeks called The Art Prophets, about visionary art dealers and how they're able to spot new artists and movements. So I'm pretty heavily involved in writing right now. But sure, I'd love to go back out there. It was one of the great times of my life. Met some nice people, had some great times, drank a lot of beer. it was a good time.
Well, you know, the caller earlier had said, you know, it's just people just out there to be goofy or whatever. And it really sounded like, but it sounded like, you know, they're out there, I mean, I guess to just support their lifestyle, which, I mean, seems like a very nice, laid-back kind of lifestyle.
Well, it's a hard lifestyle. It's a lot of fun when you find something. But, you know, these are not people who have 9-to-5 jobs with pension plans and health insurance and all that. It's, you know, they live by their wits, and they're out in the field 300 days a year almost, if you can believe that. And they're out there looking, and you can go days and weeks and months without finding anything of any value. Then all of a sudden you find something wonderful, and you're in the money. And it's a wonderful life if you can live that way. You know, not everybody can live wondering when they're going to see their next paycheck. But there are people out there who love that sense of adventure. Every day is a treasure hunt when they get up, and they love that mentality. They live for it. It's a high. It's like getting high every day. They love it.
We have about 5 minutes left in the program, and certainly we'll take happy to take another call or two before we finish up here. We mentioned a little bit ago about, you know, kind of the future and, you know, the fact that a lot of these museums are maybe filling up with dinosaurs already. I mean, is there much encouragement for budding young paleontologists now? Is there a new generation?
You make a good point. I'm glad you brought this up. No, the answer is no. And it's very sad in this, you know, age of high tech. Everyone wants to design video games or do something on the internet, or, you know what I'm saying? Children don't have, their attention span has shifted. Everything's sped up. And there's very little encouragement for a young person to go into paleontology. Why would they want to do that? You know what I'm saying? It's just a different world now. And it's very sad, so I don't want to sound negative, but I don't see a great future to all this. You know, with the museums, like you pointed out, filling up, and, you know, I don't, something has to be done by these universities and the academics to encourage young people to get into this.
You know, that was always, you know, my take on it, and this is why I didn't become a paleontologist. I'm like, well, that seems like too much work and too much digging.
It is a lot of work. And if you go the academic route, you know, you got to get a PhD, basically, and there are very few jobs at natural history museums, very few, and very few at universities. Someone has to die. People stay for life. It's terrible. But something, I don't know. Who knows? You know, it'll all work out, hopefully.
So do you still think you have Rex disease? You talked about Rex disease in there.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it eluded me. I'd love to take another shot at looking for a Rex. And the only way you find something is to be out there. The more time you spend out in the field, the better your odds, obviously, of finding something of significance. If you know where to look, if you're looking in the right place, anyone can find one. But right place, right time, you know, a lot of it's just random. A lot of it's just good luck. You know, a fly could buzz by your face and force you to turn your head to the left. And you look down on the ground and you see the tip of a bone. You go, oh, my God. That's how it can happen. It's that unpredictable.
And we have just a minute or so left. And I was, you know, curious, too, you know, I guess now with so many bones being, you said there's so many casts being used instead of bones. I mean, when people go to the museum now, I mean, how much of the dinosaurs are likely to be real?
Well, what you're going to see now is real, but they're, you know, they're often missing bones that are casts that are worked into the general skeleton. So most of it's real. But in the future, less of it will be. If there are new museums being built, private museums being built. There's a museum in Colorado owned by Mike Trebold, which is leading the way into the future. And by that I mean everything is for sale in his dinosaur museum. They don't hand you a price list when you walk in. But basically, they let it be known to people who are interested, we'll sell all these things if you'd like, or we'll make you a cast of one for a lot less money. So dinosaurs for profit may be the future.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it at that. Our guest in this hour of focus was Richard Polsky. He's author of the book Boneheads, My Search for T-Rex. It's available in hardcover from Council Oak Books, and I can recommend it. It was a very fun read, and thank you so much for being my guest this
Thanks.
Morning.
Thanks. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Obviously, of finding something of significance. If you know where to look, if you're looking in the right place, anyone can find one, but right place, right time. You know, a lot of it's just random. A lot of it's just good luck. You know, a fly could buzz by your face and force you to turn your head to the left. And you look down on the ground and you see the tip of a bone. You go, oh, my God. That's how it can happen. It's that unpredictable.
And we have just a minute or so left. And I was, you know, curious, too, you know, I guess now with so many bones being, you said there's so many casts being used instead of bones. I mean, when people go to the museum now, I mean, how much of the dinosaurs are likely to be real?
Well, what you're going to see now is real, but they're, you know, they're often missing bones that are casts that are worked into the general skeleton. So most of it's real. But in the future, less of it will be. If there are new museums being built, private museums being built. There's a museum in Colorado owned by Mike Trebold, which is leading the way into the future. And by that I mean everything is for sale in his dinosaur museum. They don't hand you a price list when you walk in. But basically, they let it be known to people who are interested, we'll sell all these things if you'd like, or we'll make you a cast of one for a lot less money. So dinosaurs for profit may be the future.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it at that. Our guest in this hour of focus was Richard Polsky. He's author of the book Boneheads, My Search for T-Rex. It's available in hardcover from Council Oak Books, and I can recommend it. It was a very fun read, and thank you so much for being my guest this
Thanks.
Morning.
Thanks. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of chocolates, cheeses, oils, balsamic vinegar, jams, spices, barbecue sauces, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. The screen is totally green today with double-digit increases in the corn as well as in the Chicago wheat market and some single-digit gains over in the soybeans. Let's look at particulars. We'll begin in Kansas City where December wheat is trading at $7.53, up 9. March at 767 and 3 quarters, up 9. May, 778, up 12 and 3 quarters. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 661 and a quarter, up 13. March, 693 and 3 quarters, now 95, up 11 and 3 quarters. The May at 710 and a half, up 11. December corn at 659.5, up 11.5. March, 672.75, up 11.5. May, 680, up 11.25. July, 685.25, up 12.5. September, 630, up 12.5. November soybeans, 1268, up 8.25. January, 1279.25, up 8. March, 1287, up 9. May, 1292, up 9.25. July, at $13.25, and they are up 10. October soybean meal, 329, up 280. December, 332.80, up 260. December soybean oil, 5283, up 61. December, 5302, up 62. October live cattle at 120.55, up 82.5. December 120.65, up 92.5.